am happy now to be relieved of these mental agonies. With hearty and comradely greetings, your Adolf Hitler. At 3 o'clock in the morning of June 22nd, a bare half hour before the German troops jumped off, Ambassador von Bismarck awakened Ciano in Rome to deliver Hitler's long missive, which the Italian foreign minister then telephoned to Mussolini, who was resting at his summer place at Riccione. It was not the first time that the Duce had been wakened from his sleep in the middle of the night by a message from his Axis partner, and he resented it. "Not even I disturb my servants at night," Mussolini fretted to Ciano, "but the Germans make me jump out of bed at any hour without the least consideration." Nevertheless, as soon as Mussolini had rubbed the sleep from his eyes, he gave orders for an immediate declaration of war on the Soviet Union. He was now completely a prisoner of the Germans. He knew it and resented it. "I hope for only one thing," he told Ciano, "that in this war in the East the Germans lose a lot of feathers." Still, he realized that his own future now depended wholly on German arms. The Germans would win in Russia, he was sure, but he hoped that at least they would get a bloody nose. He could not know, nor did he suspect, nor did anyone else in the West on either side, that they would get much worse. On Sunday morning, June 22nd, the day Napoleon had crossed the Niemen in 1812 on his way to Moscow, and exactly a year after Napoleon's country, France, had capitulated at Compiègne, Adolf Hitler's armored, mechanized, and hitherto invincible armies poured across the Niemen and various other rivers and penetrated swiftly into Russia. The Red Army, despite all the warnings and the warning signs, was, as General Halder noted in his diary the first day, tactically surprised along the entire front. There is a curious notation in Halder's diary that first day, after mentioning that at noon the Russian radio stations, which the Germans were monitoring, had come back on the air. He writes, "They have asked Japan to mediate the political and economic differences between Russia and Germany and remain in active contact with the German Foreign Office." Did Stalin believe, 9 hours after the attack, that he somehow might get it called off? All the first bridges were captured intact. "In fact," says Halder, "at most places along the border, the Russians were not even deployed for action and were overrun before they could organize resistance. Hundreds of Soviet planes were destroyed on the flying fields." General Günter Blumentritt, chief of staff of the Fourth Army, later recalled that a little after midnight on the 21st, when the German artillery had already zeroed on its targets, the Berlin-Moscow express train chugged through the German lines on the Bug and across the river into Brest-Litovsk, without incident. It struck him as a weird moment. Almost equally weird to him was that the Russian artillery did not respond even when the assault began. "The Russians," he subsequently wrote, "were taken entirely by surprise on our front." As dawn broke, German signal stations picked up the Red Army radio networks. "We are being fired on. What shall we do?" Blumentritt quotes one Russian message as saying. Back came the answer from headquarters. "You must be insane, and why is your signal not in code?" The Fatal Decisions, edited by Seymour Frieden and William Richardson. Within a few days, tens of thousands of prisoners began to pour in. Whole armies were quickly encircled. It seemed like the Feldzug in Poland all over again. It is hardly too much to say, the usually cautious Halder noted in his diary on July 3rd after going over the latest General Staff reports, that the Feldzug against Russia has been won in 14 days. In a matter of weeks, he added, it would all be over. Chapter 24. A Turn of the Tide. By the beginning of autumn 1941, Hitler believed that Russia was finished. Within 3 weeks of the opening of the campaign, Field Marshal von Bock's Army Group Center, with 30 infantry divisions and 15 panzer or motorized divisions, had pushed 450 miles from Bialystok to Smolensk. Moscow lay but 200 miles farther east along the high road which Napoleon had taken in 1812. To the north, Field Marshal von Leib's army group, 21 infantry and 6 armored divisions strong, was moving rapidly up through the Baltic states toward Leningrad. To the south, Field Marshal von Rundstedt's army group of 25 infantry, 4 motorized, 4 mountain and 5 panzer divisions was advancing toward the Dnieper River and Kiev, capital of the fertile Ukraine, which Hitler coveted. So Planmessig, according to plan, as the OKW communiques put it, was the German progress along a 1,000-mile front from the Baltic to the Black Sea, and so confident was the Nazi dictator that it would continue at an accelerated pace as one Soviet army after another was surrounded or dispersed, that on July 14th, the bare 3 weeks after the invasion had begun, he issued a directive advising that the strength of the army could be considerably reduced in the near future, and that armament production would be concentrated on naval ships and Luftwaffe planes, especially the latter, for the conduct of the war against the last remaining enemy, Britain, and, he added, against America should the case arise. By the end of September, he instructed the High Command to prepare to disband 40 infantry divisions so that this additional manpower could be utilized by industry. Russia's two greatest cities, Leningrad, which Peter the Great had built as the capital on the Baltic, and Moscow, the ancient and now Bolshevik capital, seemed to Hitler about to fall. On September 18th, he issued strict orders. A capitulation of Leningrad or Moscow is not to be accepted, even if offered. What was to happen to them, he made clear to his commanders in a directive of September 29th. The Führer has decided to have St. Petersburg, Leningrad, wiped off the face of the earth. The further existence of this large city is of no interest once Soviet Russia is overthrown. The intention is to close in on the city and raze it to the ground by artillery and by continuous air attack. Requests that the city be taken over will be turned down, for the problem of the survival of the population and of supplying it with food is one which cannot and should not be solved by us. In this war for existence, we have no interest in keeping even part of this great city's population. A few weeks later, Goering told Chano, "This year between 20 and 30 million persons will die of hunger in Russia. Perhaps it is well that it should be so, for certain nations must be decimated. But even if it were not, nothing can be done about it. It is obvious that if humanity is condemned to die of hunger, the last to die will be our two peoples. In the camps for Russian prisoners, they have begun to eat each other." Chano's diplomatic papers, pages 464 to 465. That same week, on October 3rd, Hitler returned to Berlin and, in an address to the German people, proclaimed the collapse of the Soviet Union. "I declare today, and I declare it without any reservation," he said, "that the enemy in the East has been struck down and will never rise again. Behind our troops there already lies a territory twice the size of the German Reich when I came to power in 1933. When, on October 8th, Orel, a key city south of Moscow, fell, Hitler sent his press chief, Otto Dietrich, flying back to Berlin to tell the correspondents of the world's leading newspapers there the next day that the last intact Soviet armies, those of Marshal Timoshenko, defending Moscow, were locked in two steel German pockets before the capital, that the southern armies of Marshal Budyonny were routed and dispersed, and that 60 to 70 divisions of Marshal Voroshilov's army were surrounded in Leningrad. "For all military purposes," Dietrich concluded smugly, "Soviet Russia is done with. The British dream of a two-front war is dead." These public boasts of Hitler and Dietrich were, to say the least, premature. Not as premature, however, as the warnings of the American General Staff, which in July had confidentially informed American editors and Washington correspondents that the collapse of the Soviet Union was only a matter of a few weeks. It is not surprising that the declarations of Hitler and Dr. Dietrich early in October 1941 were widely believed in the United States and Britain as well as in Germany and elsewhere. In reality, the Russians, despite the surprise with which they were taken on June 22nd, their subsequent heavy losses in men and equipment, their rapid withdrawal and the entrapment of some of their best armies, had begun in July to put up a mounting resistance such as the Wehrmacht had never encountered before. Halder's diary and the reports of such frontline commanders as General Guderian, who led a large panzer group on the Central Front, began to be peppered and then laden with accounts of severe fighting, desperate Russian stands and counterattacks, and heavy casualties to German as well as Soviet troops. "The conduct of the Russian troops," General Blumentritt wrote later, "even in this first battle, for Minsk, was in striking contrast to the behavior of the Poles and the Western Allies in defeat. Even when encircled, the Russians stood their ground and fought. And there proved to be more of them, and with better equipment than Adolf Hitler had dreamed was possible. Fresh Soviet divisions, which German intelligence had no inkling of, were continually being thrown into battle. "It is becoming ever clearer," Halder wrote in his diary on August 11th, "that we underestimated the strength of the Russian colossus, not only in the economic and transportation sphere, but above all in the military. At the beginning, we reckoned with some 200 enemy divisions, and we have already identified 360. When a dozen of them are destroyed, the Russians throw in another dozen. On this broad expanse, our front is too thin. It has no depth. As a result, the repeated enemy attacks often meet with some success." Rundstedt put it bluntly to Allied interrogators after the war. "I realized," he said, "soon after the attack was begun, that everything that had been written about Russia was nonsense." Several generals, Guderian, Blumentritt, and Sepp Dietrich among them, have left reports expressing astonishment at their first encounter with the Russian T-34 tank, of which they had not previously heard and which was so heavily armored that the shells from the German anti-tank guns bounced harmlessly off it. "The appearance of this panzer," Blumentritt said later, "marked the beginning of what came to be called the tank terror. Also, for the first time in the war, the Germans did not have the benefit of overwhelming superiority in the air to protect their ground troops and scout ahead. Despite the heavy losses on the ground in the first day of the campaign and in early combat, Soviet fighter planes kept appearing, like the fresh divisions, out of nowhere. Moreover, the swiftness of the German advance and the lack of suitable airfields in Russia left the German fighter bases too far back to provide effective cover at the front. At several stages in the advance," General von Kleist later reported, "my panzer forces were handicapped through lack of cover overhead." There was another German miscalculation about the Russians, which Kleist mentioned to Little Hart and which, of course, was shared by most of the other peoples of the West that summer. "Hopes of victory," Kleist said, "were largely built on the prospect that the invasion would produce a political upheaval in Russia. Too high hopes were built on the belief that Stalin would be overthrown by his own people if he suffered heavy defeats. The belief was fostered by the Führer's political advisers. Indeed, Hitler had told Jodl, 'We have only to kick in the door and the whole rotten structure will come crashing down.'" The opportunity to kick in the door seemed to the Führer to be at hand halfway through July, when there occurred the first great controversy over strategy in the German high command, and led to a decision by the Führer, over the protests of most of the top generals, which Halder thought proved to be the greatest strategic blunder of the Eastern campaign. The issue was simple but fundamental. Should Bach's Army Group Center, the most powerful and so far the most successful of the three main German armies, push on the 200 miles to Moscow from Smolensk, which it had reached on July 16th, or should the original plan, which Hitler had laid down in the December 18th directive and which called for the main thrusts on the north and south flanks, be adhered to? In other words, was Moscow the prize goal or Leningrad and the Ukraine? The Army High Command, led by Brauchitsch and Halder and supported by Bach, whose Central Army Group was moving up the main highway to Moscow, and by Guderian, whose panzer forces were leading it, insisted on an all-out drive for the Soviet capital. There was much more to their argument than merely stressing the psychological value of capturing the enemy capital. Moscow, they pointed out to Hitler, was a vital source of armament production, and even more important, the center of the Russian transportation and communications system. Take it, and the Soviets would not only be deprived of an essential source of arms, but would be unable to move troops and supplies to the distant fronts, which thereafter would weaken, wither, and collapse. But there was a final conclusive argument which the generals advanced to the former corporal who was now their supreme commander. All their intelligence reports showed that the main Russian forces were now being concentrated before Moscow for an all-out defense of the capital. Just east of Smolensk, a Soviet army of 500,000 men, which had extricated itself from Bach's double envelopment, was digging in to bar further German progress toward the capital. The center of gravity of Russian strength, Halder wrote in a report prepared for the Allies immediately after the war, was therefore in front of Army Group Center. The general staff had been brought up with the idea that it must be the aim of an operation to defeat the military power of the enemy, and it therefore considered the next and most pressing task to be to defeat the forces of Timoshenko by concentrating all available forces at Army Group Center, to advance on Moscow, to take this nerve center of enemy resistance, and to destroy the new enemy formations. The assembly for this attack had to be carried out as soon as possible because the season was advanced. Army Group North was in the meantime to fulfill its original mission and to try to contact the Finns. Army Group South was to advance farther east to tie down the strongest possible enemy force. After oral discussions between the General Staff and the Supreme Command, OKW, had failed, the Commander-in-Chief of the Army, Brauchitsch, submitted a memorandum of the General Staff to Hitler. This, we learn from Halder's diary, was done on August 18th. The effect, says Halder, was explosive. Hitler had his hungry eyes on the food belt and industrial areas of the Ukraine and on the Russian oil fields just beyond in the Caucasus. Besides, he thought he saw a golden opportunity to entrap Budyani's armies east of the Dnieper beyond Kiev, which still held out. He also wanted to capture Leningrad and join up with the Finns in the north. To accomplish these twin aims, several infantry and panzer divisions from Army Group Center would have to be detached and sent north, and especially south. Moscow could wait. On August 21st, Hitler hurled a new directive at his rebellious general staff. Halder copied it out word for word in his diary the next day. The proposals of the army for the continuation of the operations in the east do not accord with my intentions. The most important objective to attain before the onset of winter is not the capture of Moscow, but the taking of the Crimea, the industrial and coal mining areas of the Donetsk Basin, and the cutting off of Russian oil supplies from the Caucasus. In the north, it is the locking up of Leningrad and the union with the Finns. The Soviet Fifth Army on the Dnieper in the south, whose stubborn resistance had annoyed Hitler for several days, must, he laid it down, be utterly destroyed. The Ukraine and the Crimea occupied, Leningrad surrounded, and a junction with the Finns achieved. Only then, he concluded, will the conditions be created whereby Timoshenko's army can be attacked and successfully defeated. Thus, commented Halder bitterly, the aim of defeating decisively the Russian armies in front of Moscow was subordinated to the desire to obtain a valuable industrial area and to advance in the direction of Russian oil. Hitler now became obsessed with the idea of capturing both Leningrad and Stalingrad, for he persuaded himself that if these two holy cities of communism were to fall, Russia would collapse. To add insult to injury to the field marshals and the generals who did not appreciate his strategic genius, Hitler sent what Halder called a counter-memorandum to that of the army of the 18th, which the general staff chief described as full of insults, such as stating that the army high command was full of minds fossilized in out-of-date theories. Unbearable, unheard of, the limit, Halder snorted in his diary the next day. He conferred all afternoon and evening with Field Marshal von Brauchitsch about the Führer's inadmissible mixing into the business of the Army High Command and General Staff, finally proposing that the head of the army and he himself resign their posts. Brauchitsch refused, Halder noted, because it wouldn't be practical and would change nothing. The gutless field marshal had already, as on so many other occasions, capitulated to the one-time corporal. When General Guderian arrived at the Führer's headquarters the next day, August 23rd, and was egged on by Halder to try to talk Hitler out of his disastrous decision, though the hard-bitten panzer leader needed no urging, he was met by Brauchitsch. "I forbid you," the army commander-in-chief said, "to mention the question of Moscow to the Führer. The operation to the south has been ordered. The problem now is simply how it is to be carried out. Discussion is pointless." Nevertheless, when Guderian was ushered into the presence of Hitler, neither Brauchitsch nor Halder accompanied him, he disobeyed orders and argued as strongly as he could for the immediate assault on Moscow. "Hitler let me speak to the end," Guderian later wrote. He then described in detail the considerations which had led him to make a different decision. He said that the raw materials and agriculture of the Ukraine were vitally necessary for the future prosecution of the war. He spoke of the need of neutralizing the Crimea, that Soviet aircraft carrier for attacking the Romanian oil fields. For the first time I heard him use the phrase, My generals know nothing about the economic aspects of war. He had given strict orders that the attack on Kiev was to be the immediate strategic objective, and all actions were to be carried out with that in mind. I here saw for the first time a spectacle with which I was later to become very familiar. All those present, Keitel, Jodl, and others, nodded in agreement with every sentence that Hitler uttered, while I was left alone with my point of view. But Halder had at no point in the previous discussions nodded his agreement. When Guderian saw him the next day and reported his failure to get Hitler to change his mind, he says the General Staff Chief, to my amazement, suffered a complete nervous collapse, which led him to make accusations and imputations which were utterly unjustified. Halder, in his diary of August 24th, gives quite a different version. He accuses Guderian of irresponsibly changing his mind after seeing Hitler, and muses how useless it is to try to change a man's character. If he suffered, as Guderian alleges, a complete nervous collapse, his pedantic diary notes that day indicate that he quickly recovered. This was the most severe crisis in the German military high command since the beginning of the war. Worse were to follow, with adversity. In itself, Rundstedt's offensive in the south, made possible by the reinforcement of Guderian's panzer forces and infantry divisions withdrawn from the central front, was, as Guderian put it, a great tactical victory. Kiev itself fell on September 19th, German units had already penetrated 150 miles beyond it, and on the 26th, the Battle of Kiev ended with the encirclement and surrender of 665,000 Russian prisoners, according to the German claim. To Hitler it was the greatest battle in the history of the world. But though it was a singular achievement, some of his generals were more skeptical of its strategic significance. Bach's armorless army group in the center had been forced to cool its heels for 2 months along the Desna River, just beyond Smolensk. The autumn rains, which would turn the Russian roads into quagmires, were drawing near, and after them, the winter, the cold, and the snow. The Great Drive on Moscow. Reluctantly, Hitler gave in to the urging of Brauchitsch, Halder, and Bach and consented to the resumption of the drive on Moscow. But too late. Halder saw him on the afternoon of September 5th, and now the Führer, his mind made up, was in a hurry to get to the Kremlin. Get started on the Central Front within 8 to 10 days, the Supreme Commander ordered. Impossible, Halder exclaimed in his diary. Encircle them, beat, and destroy them, Hitler added, promising to return to Army Group Center Guderian's Panzer Group, then still heavily engaged in the Ukraine, and add Reinhardt's Tank Corps from the Leningrad Front. But it was not until the beginning of October that the armored forces could be brought back, refitted, and made ready. On October 2nd, the Great Offensive was finally launched. Typhoon was the code name. A mighty wind, a cyclone, was to hit the Russians, destroy their last fighting forces before Moscow, and bring the Soviet Union tumbling down. But here again the Nazi dictator became a victim of his megalomania. Taking the Russian capital before winter came was not enough. He gave orders that Field Marshal von Leib in the north was, at the same time, to capture Leningrad, make contact with the Finns beyond the city, and drive on and cut the Murmansk Railway. Also, at the same time, Rundstedt was to clear the Black Sea coast, take Rostov, seize the Maikop oil fields, and push forward to Stalingrad on the Volga, thus severing Stalin's last link with the Caucasus. When Rundstedt tried to explain to Hitler that this meant an advance of more than 400 miles beyond the Dnieper, with his left flank dangerously exposed, the Supreme Commander told him that the Russians in the south were now incapable of offering serious resistance. Rundstedt, who says that he laughed aloud at such ridiculous orders, was soon to find the contrary. The German drive along the old road which Napoleon had taken to Moscow at first rolled along with all the fury of a typhoon. In the first fortnight of October, in what later Blumentritt called a textbook battle, the Germans encircled two Soviet armies between Vyazma and Bryansk and claimed to have taken 650,000 prisoners along with 5,000 guns and 1,200 tanks. By October 20th, German armored spearheads were within 40 miles of Moscow, and the Soviet ministries and foreign embassies were hastily evacuated to Kuibyshov on the Volga. Even the sober Halder, who had fallen off his horse and broken a collarbone and was temporarily hospitalized, now believed that with bold leadership and favorable weather, Moscow could be taken before the severe Russian winter set in. The fall rains, however, had commenced. Rasputitsa, the period of mud, set in. The great army, moving on wheels, was slowed down and often forced to halt. Tanks had to be withdrawn from battle to pull guns and ammunition trucks out of the mire. Chains and couplings for this job were lacking, and bundles of rope had to be dropped by Luftwaffe transport planes, which were badly needed for lifting other military supplies. The rains began in mid-October, and, as Guderian later remembered, the next few weeks were dominated by the mud. General Blumentritt, chief of staff of Field Marshal von Kluge's Fourth Army, which was in the thick of the battle for Moscow, has vividly described the predicament. The infantrymen slithers in the mud, while many teams of horses are needed to drag each gun forward. All-wheeled vehicles sink up to their axles in the slime. Even tractors can only move with great difficulty. A large portion of our heavy artillery was soon stuck fast. The strain that all this caused our already exhausted troops can perhaps be imagined. For the first time, there crept into the diary of Holder and the reports of Guderian, Blumentritt, and other German generals signs of doubt, and then of despair. It spread to the lower officers and the troops in the field, or perhaps it stemmed from them. And now, when Moscow was already almost in sight, Blumentritt recalled, the mood both of commanders and troops began to change. Enemy resistance stiffened, and the fighting became more bitter. Many of our companies were reduced to a mere 60 or 70 men. There was a shortage of serviceable artillery and tanks. Winter, he says, was about to begin, but there was no sign of winter clothing. Far behind the front, the first partisan units were beginning to make their presence felt in the vast forests and swamps. Supply columns were frequently ambushed. Now, Blumentritt remembered, the ghosts of the Grand Army, which had taken this same road to Moscow, and the memory of Napoleon's fate began to haunt the dreams of the Nazi conquerors. The German generals began to read or reread Caulaincourt's grim account of the French conquerors' disastrous winter in Russia in 1812. Far to the south, where the weather was a little warmer but the rain and the mud were just as bad, things were not going well either. Kleist's tanks had entered Rostov at the mouth of the Don on November 21st amidst much fanfare from Dr. Goebbels's propaganda band that the gateway to the Caucasus had been opened. It did not remain open very long. Both Kleist and Rundstedt realized that Rostov could not be held. 5 days later, the Russians retook it, and the Germans, attacked on both the northern and southern flanks, were in headlong retreat back 50 miles to the Meuse River, where Kleist and Rundstedt had wished in the first place to establish a winter line. The retreat from Rostov is another little turning point in the history of the Third Reich. Here was the first time that any Nazi army had ever suffered a major setback. "Our misfortunes began with Rostov," Guderian afterward commented. "That was the writing on the wall." It cost Field Marshal von Rundstedt, the senior officer in the German army, his command, as he was retreating to the Meuse. "Suddenly an order came to me," he subsequently told Allied interrogators, "from the Führer. Remain where you are and retreat no further." I immediately wired back, "It is madness to attempt to hold. In the first place, the troops cannot do it, and in the second place, if they do not retreat, they will be destroyed. I repeat that this order be rescinded or that you find someone else." That same night, the Führer's reply arrived. "I am acceding to your request. Please give up your command." "I then," said Rundstedt, "went home." "Größte Aufregung, greatest excitement by the Führer," Holder noted in his diary on November 30th in describing Rundstedt's retreat to the Meuse and Hitler's dismissal of the Field Marshal. "The Führer calls in Brauchitsch and hurls reproaches and abuse at him." Holder had begun his diary that day by noting the figures of German casualties up to November 26th. "Total losses of the Eastern armies, not counting the sick, 743,112 officers and men, 23% of the entire force of 3.2 million. On December 1st, Holder recorded the replacement of Rundstedt by Reichenau, who still commanded the 6th Army, which he had led in France and which had been having a hard time of it to the north of Kleist's armored divisions, which were retreating from Rostov. Reichenau phones the Führer, Holder wrote, and asks permission to withdraw tonight to the Meuse line. Permission is given. So we are exactly where we were yesterday, but time and strength have been sacrificed and Rundstedt lost. The health of Braukitsch, he added, as the result of the continuing excitement, is again causing anxiety. On November 10th, Holder had recorded that the army chief had suffered a severe heart attack. This mania for ordering distant troops to stand fast, no matter what their peril, perhaps saved the German army from complete collapse in the shattering months ahead, though many generals dispute it, but it was to lead to Stalingrad and other disasters, and to help seal Hitler's fate. Heavy snows and sub-zero temperatures came early that winter in Russia. Guderian noted the first snow on the night of October 6th to 7th, just as the drive on Moscow was being resumed. It reminded him to ask headquarters again for winter clothing, especially for heavy boots and heavy wool socks. On October 12th, he recorded the snow as still falling. On November 3rd came the first cold wave, the thermometer dropping below the freezing point and continuing to fall. By the 7th, Guderian was reporting the first severe cases of frostbite in his ranks, and on the 13th, that the temperature had fallen to 8 degrees below 0 Fahrenheit, and that the lack of winter clothing was becoming increasingly felt. The bitter cold affected guns and machines as well as men. Ice was causing a lot of trouble, Guderian wrote, since the caulks for the tank tracks had not yet arrived. The cold made the telescopic sights useless. In order to start the engines of the tanks, fires had to be lit beneath them. Fuel was freezing on occasions, and the oil became viscous. Each regiment, of the 112th Infantry Division, had already lost some 500 men from frostbite. As a result of the cold, the machine guns were no longer able to fire, and our 37mm anti-tank guns had proved ineffective against the Russian T-34 tank. The result, says Guderian, was a panic which reached as far back as Bodorodsk. This was the first time that such a thing had occurred during the Russian campaign, and it was a warning that the combat ability of our infantry was at an end. But not only of the infantry. On November 21st, Holder scribbled in his diary that Guderian had telephoned to say that his panzer troops had reached their end. This tough, aggressive tank commander admits that on this very day he decided to visit the commander of Army Group Center, Bach, and request that the orders he had received be changed, since he could see no way of carrying them out. He was in a deep mood of depression, writing on the same day, "The icy cold, the lack of shelter, the shortage of clothing, the heavy losses of men and equipment, the wretched state of our fuel supplies, all this makes the duties of a commander a misery, and the longer it goes on, the more I am crushed by the enormous responsibility I have to bear." In retrospect, Guderian added, "Only he who saw the endless expanse of Russian snow during this winter of our misery, and felt the icy wind that blew across it, burying in snow every object in its path, who drove for hour after hour through that no-man's land, only at last to find too thin shelter with insufficiently clothed, half-starved men, and who also saw, by contrast, the well-fed, warmly clad, and fresh Siberians, fully equipped for winter fighting, can truly judge the events which now occurred." Those events may now be briefly narrated, but not without first stressing one point. Terrible as the Russian winter was, and granted that the Soviet troops were naturally better prepared for it than the German, the main factor in what is now to be set down was not the weather, but the fierce fighting of the Red Army troops, and their indomitable will not to give up. The diary of Holder and the reports of the field commanders, which constantly express amazement at the extent and severity of Russian attacks and counterattacks, and despair at the German setbacks and losses, are proof of that. The Nazi generals could not understand why the Russians, considering the nature of their tyrannical regime and the disastrous effects of the first German blows, did not collapse, as had the French and so many others, with less excuse. "With amazement and disappointment," Blumentritt wrote, "we discovered in late October and early November that the beaten Russians seemed quite unaware that as a military force they had almost ceased to exist." Guderian tells of meeting an old retired Tsarist general at Orel on the road to Moscow. "If only you had come 20 years ago," he told the panzer general, "we should have welcomed you with open arms. But now it's too late. We were just beginning to get on our feet, and now you arrive and throw us back 20 years, so that we will have to start from the beginning all over again. Now we are fighting for Russia, and in that cause we are all united." Yet, as November approached its end amidst fresh blizzards and continued sub-zero temperatures, Moscow seemed within grasp to Hitler and most of his generals. North, south, and west of the capital, German armies had reached points within 20 to 30 miles of their goal. To Hitler, poring over the map at his headquarters far off in East Prussia, the last stretch seemed no distance at all. His armies had advanced 500 miles. They had only 20 to 30 miles to go. "One final heave," he told Jodl in mid-November, "and we shall triumph." On the telephone to Halder on November 22nd, Field Marshal von Bock, directing Army Group Center in its final push for Moscow, compared the situation to the Battle of the Marne, where the last battalion thrown in decided the battle. Despite increased enemy resistance, Bock told the General Staff Chief he believed everything was attainable. By the last day of November, he was literally throwing in his last battalion. The final all-out attack on the heart of the Soviet Union was set for the next day, December 1, 1941. It stumbled on a steely resistance. The greatest tank force ever concentrated on one front, General Hoeppner's 4th Tank Group and General Hermann Hoth's 3rd Tank Group just north of Moscow and driving south, Guderian's 2nd Panzer Army just to the south of the capital and pushing north from Tula, Kluge's great 4th Army in the middle and fighting its way due east through the forests that surrounded the city. On this formidable array were pinned Hitler's high hopes. By December 2nd, a reconnaissance battalion of the 258th Infantry Division had penetrated to Khimki, a suburb of Moscow, within sight of the spires of the Kremlin, but was driven out the next morning by a few Russian tanks and a motley force of hastily mobilized workers from the city's factories. This was the nearest the German troops ever got to Moscow. It was their first and last glimpse of the Kremlin. Already on the evening of December 1st, Bock, who was now suffering severe stomach cramps, had telephoned Halder to say that he could no longer operate with his weakened troops. The General Staff Chief had tried to cheer him on. "One must try," he said, "to bring the enemy down by a last expenditure of force. If that proves impossible, then we will have to draw new conclusions." The next day, Halder jotted in his diary, "Enemy resistance has reached its peak." On the following day, December 3rd, Bock was again on the phone to the Chief of the General Staff, who noted his message in his diary. "Spearheads of the 4th Army again pulled back because the flanks could not come forward. The moment must be faced when the strength of our troops is at an end." When Bock spoke for the first time of going over to the defensive, Halder tried to remind him that the best defense was to stick to the attack. It was easier said than done in view of the Russians and the weather. The next day, December 4th, Guderian, whose 2nd Panzer Army had been halted in its attempt to take Moscow from the south, reported that the thermometer had fallen to 31 degrees below zero. The next day it dropped another 5 degrees. His tanks, he said, were almost immobilized, and he was threatened on his flanks and in the rear north of Tula. December 5th was the critical day. Everywhere along the 200-mile semicircular front around Moscow, the Germans had been stopped. By evening, Guderian was notifying Bock that he was not only stopped, but must pull back, and Bock was telephoning Halder that his strength was at an end, and Brauchitsch was telling his chief of the general staff in despair that he was quitting as commander-in-chief of the army. It was a dark and bitter day for the German generals. "This was the first time," Guderian later wrote, "that I had to take a decision of this sort, and none was more difficult. Our attack on Moscow had broken down. All the sacrifices and endurance of our brave troops had been in vain. We had suffered a grievous defeat." At Kluge's 4th Army headquarters, Blumentritt, the chief of staff, realized that the turning point had been reached. Recalling it later, he wrote, "Our hopes of knocking Russia out of the war in 1941 had been dashed at the very last minute." The next day, December 6th, General Georgi Zhukov, who had replaced Marshal Timoshenko as commander of the Central Front but 6 weeks before, struck. On the 200-mile front before Moscow, he unleashed 7 armies and 2 cavalry corps, 100 divisions in all, consisting of troops that were either fresh or battle-tried and were equipped and trained to fight in the bitter cold and the deep snow. The blow which this relatively unknown general now delivered with such a formidable force of infantry, artillery, tanks, cavalry, and planes, which Hitler had not faintly suspected existed, was so sudden and so shattering that the German army in the Third Reich never fully recovered from it. For a few weeks during the rest of that cold and bitter December and on into January, it seemed that the beaten and retreating German armies, their front continually pierced by Soviet breakthroughs, might disintegrate and perish in the Russian snows, as had Napoleon's Grand Army just 130 years before. At several crucial moments it came very close to that. Perhaps it was Hitler's granite will and determination, and certainly it was the fortitude of the German soldier, that saved the armies of the Third Reich from a complete debacle. But the failure was great. The Red Armies had been crippled, but not destroyed. Moscow had not been taken, nor Leningrad, nor Stalingrad, nor the oil fields of the Caucasus. And the lifelines to Britain and America, to the north and to the south, remained open. For the first time in more than 2 years of unbroken military victories, the armies of Hitler were retreating before a superior force. That was not all. The failure was greater than that. Halder realized this, at least later. The myth of the invincibility of the German army, he wrote, was broken. There would be more German victories in Russia when another summer came around, but they could never restore the myth. December 6, 1941, then, is another turning point in the short history of the Third Reich and one of the most fateful ones. Hitler's power had reached its zenith. From now on it was to decline, sapped by the growing counterblows of the nations against which he had chosen to make aggressive war. A drastic shake-up in the German high command and among the field commanders now took place. As the armies fell back over the icy roads and snowy fields before the Soviet counteroffensive, the heads of the German generals began to roll. Rundstedt, as we have already seen, was relieved of command of the southern armies because he had been forced to retreat from Rostov. Field Marshal von Bock's stomach pains became worse with the setbacks in December, and he was replaced on December 18th by Field Marshal von Kluge, whose battered Fourth Army was being pushed back, forever, from the vicinity of Moscow. Even the dashing General Guderian, the originator of massive armored warfare which had so revolutionized modern battle, was cashiered on Christmas Day for ordering a retreat without permission from above. General Hoeppner, an equally brilliant tank commander whose 4th Armored Group had come within sight of Moscow on the north and then been pushed back, was abruptly dismissed by Hitler on the same grounds, stripped of his rank and forbidden to wear a uniform. General Hans Count von Sponeck, who had received the Ritterkreuz for leading the airborne landings at The Hague the year before, received a severer chastisement for pulling back one division of his corps in the Crimea on December 29th, after Russian troops had landed by sea behind him. He was not only summarily stripped of his rank, but imprisoned, court-martialed, and, at the insistence of Hitler, sentenced to death. He was not executed until after the July 1944 plot against Hitler, in which he was in no way involved. Even the obsequious Keitel was in trouble with the Supreme Commander. Even he had enough sense to see during the first days of December that a general withdrawal around Moscow was necessary in order to avert disaster. But when he got up enough courage to say so to Hitler, the latter turned on him and gave him a tongue-lashing, shouting that he was a blockhead. Jodl found the unhappy OKW chief a little later sitting at a desk writing out his resignation, a revolver at one side. Jodl quietly removed the weapon and persuaded Keitel, apparently without too much difficulty, to stay on and to continue to swallow the Führer's insults, which he did with amazing endurance to the very end. The strain of leading an army which could not always win under a supreme commander who insisted that it always do had brought about renewed heart attacks for Field Marshal von Brauchitsch, and by the time Zhukov's counteroffensive began, he was determined to step down as commander-in-chief. He returned to headquarters from a trip to the receding front on December 15th, and Halder found him very beaten down. Brauchitsch no longer sees any way out, Halder noted in his diary, for the rescue of the army from its desperate position. The head of the army was at the end of his rope. He had asked Hitler on December 7th to relieve him, and he renewed the request on December 17th. It was formally granted 2 days later. What the Führer really thought of the man he himself had named to head the army, he told to Goebbels 3 months later. The Führer spoke of him, Brauchitsch, only in terms of contempt, Goebbels wrote in his diary on March 20, 1942. A vain, cowardly wretch and a nincompoop. To his cronies, Hitler said of Brauchitsch, "He's no soldier. He's a man of straw." If Brauchitsch had remained at his post only for another few weeks, things would have ended in catastrophe. There was some speculation in army circles as to who would succeed Brauchitsch, but it was as wide of the mark as the speculation years before as to who would succeed Hindenburg. On December 19th, Hitler called in Halder and informed him that he himself was taking over as commander-in-chief of the army. Halder could stay on as chief of the general staff if he wanted to, and he wanted to. But from now on, Hitler made it clear he was personally running the army, as he ran almost everything else in Germany. "This little matter of operational command," Hitler told him, "is something anyone can do. The task of the commander-in-chief of the army is to train the army in a National Socialist way. I know of no general who could do that, as I want it done. Consequently, I've decided to take over command of the army myself." Hitler's triumph over the Prussian officer corps was thus completed. The former Vienna vagabond and ex-corporal was now head of state, minister of war, supreme commander of the armed forces, and commander-in-chief of the army. The generals, as Halder complained in his diary, were now merely postmen, purveying Hitler's orders based on Hitler's singular conception of strategy. Actually, the megalomaniacal dictator soon would make himself something even greater, legalizing a power never before held by any man, emperor, king, or president, in the experience of the German Reichs. On April 26, 1942, he had his rubber-stamp Reichstag pass a law which gave him absolute power of life and death over every German, and simply suspended any laws which might stand in the way of this. The words of the law have to be read to be believed. "In the present war, in which the German people are faced with a struggle for their existence or their annihilation, the Führer must have all the rights postulated by him which serve to further or achieve victory. Therefore, without being bound by existing legal regulations, in his capacity as leader of the nation, supreme commander of the armed forces, head of government and supreme executive chief, as supreme justice and leader of the party, the Führer must be in a position to force with all means at his disposal every German, if necessary, whether he be common soldier or officer, low or high official or judge, leading or subordinate official of the party, worker or employer, to fulfill his duties. In case of violation of these duties, the Führer is entitled, after conscientious examination, regardless of so-called well-deserved rights, to mete out due punishment and to remove the offender from his post, rank, and position without introducing prescribed procedures." Truly, Adolf Hitler had become not only the leader of Germany, but the law. Not even in medieval times, nor further back in the barbarous tribal days, had any German arrogated such tyrannical power, nominal and legal as well as actual, to himself. But even without this added authority, Hitler was absolute master of the army, of which he had now assumed direct command. Ruthlessly, he moved that bitter winter to stem the retreat of his beaten armies and to save them from the fate of Napoleon's troops along the same frozen, snow-bound roads back from Moscow. He forbade any further withdrawals. The German generals have long debated the merits of his stubborn stand, whether it saved the troops from complete disaster, or whether it compounded the inevitable heavy losses. Most of the commanders have contended that if they had been given freedom to pull back when their position became untenable, they could have saved many men and much equipment, and been in a better position to reform and even counterattack. As it was, whole divisions were frequently overrun or surrounded and cut to pieces when a timely withdrawal would have saved them. And yet some of the generals later reluctantly admitted that Hitler's iron will in insisting that the armies stand and fight was his greatest accomplishment of the war, in that it probably did save his armies from completely disintegrating in the snow. This view is best summed up by General Blumentritt. "Hitler's fanatical order that the troops must hold fast regardless in every position and in the most impossible circumstances was undoubtedly correct. Hitler realized instinctively that any retreat across the snow and ice must, within a few days, lead to the dissolution of the front, and that if this happened, the Wehrmacht would suffer the same fate that had befallen the Grande Armée. The withdrawal could only be carried out across the open country, since the roads and tracks were blocked with snow. After a few nights, this would prove too much for the troops, who would simply lie down and die wherever they found themselves. There were no prepared positions in the rear into which they could be withdrawn, nor any sort of line to which they could hold on. General von Tippelskirch, a corps commander, agreed. It was Hitler's one great achievement. At that critical moment, the troops were remembering what they had heard about Napoleon's retreat from Moscow and living under the shadow of it. If they had once begun a retreat, it might have turned into a panic flight. There was panic in the German army, not only at the front, but far in the rear at headquarters, and it is graphically recorded in Halder's diary. "Very difficult day," he begins his journal on Christmas Day 1941. And thereafter, into the new year, he repeats the words at the head of many a day's entry as he describes each fresh Russian breakthrough and the serious situation of the various armies. December 29th. Another critical day. Dramatic long-distance telephone talk between Führer and Kluge. Führer forbids further withdrawal of northern wing of 4th Army. Very bad crisis by 9th Army, where apparently the commanders have lost their heads. At noon, an excited call from Kluge. 9th Army wishes to withdraw behind Rzeszów. January 2nd, 1942. A day of wild fighting. Grave crisis by 4th and 9th Armies. Russian breakthrough north of Maloyaroslavets tears the front wide open, and it's difficult to see at the moment how front can be restored. This situation leads Kluge to demand withdrawal of sagging front. Very stormy argument with Führer, who, however, holds to his stand. The front will remain where it is, regardless of consequences. January 3rd. The situation has become more critical as the result of the breakthrough between Maloyaroslavets and Borovsk. Kubler and Bock very excited and demand withdrawal on the north front, which is crumbling. Again a dramatic scene by Führer, who doubts courage of generals to make hard decisions. But troops simply don't hold their ground when it's 30 below zero. Führer orders. He will personally decide if any more withdrawals necessary. General Kubler had replaced Kluge on December 26th as commander of the 4th Army when the latter took over Army Group Center. Though a tough soldier, he stood the strain only 3 weeks and then was relieved by General Heinritzy. Not the Führer, but the Russian Army was by now deciding such matters. Hitler could force the German troops to stand fast and die, but he could no more stop the Soviet advance than King Canute could prevent the tides from coming in. At one moment of panic, some of the high command officers suggested that perhaps the situation could be retrieved by the employment of poison gas. "Colonel Ochsner tries to talk me into beginning gas warfare against the Russians," Halder noted in his diary on January 7th. Perhaps it was too cold. At any rate, nothing came of the suggestion. January 8th was a very critical day, as Halder noted in his journal. The breakthrough at Sukhanichi, southwest of Moscow, is becoming unbearable for Kluge. He is consequently insisting on withdrawing the 4th Army front. All day long, the field marshal was on the phone to Hitler and Halder insisting on it. Finally, in the evening, the Führer reluctantly consented. Kluge was given permission to withdraw step by step in order to protect his communications. Step by step, and sometimes more rapidly throughout that grim winter, the German armies, which had planned to celebrate Christmas in Moscow, were driven back or forced by Russian encirclements and breakthroughs to retreat. By the end of February, they found themselves from 75 to 200 miles from the capital. By the end of that freezing month, Halder was noting in his diary the cost in men of the misfired Russian adventure. "Total losses up to February 28th, he wrote down, were 1,005,636, or 31% of his entire force. Of these, 202,251 had been killed, 725,642 wounded, and 46,511 were missing. Casualties from frostbite were 112,627. This did not include the heavy losses among the Hungarians, Romanians, and Italians in Russia. With the coming of the spring thaws, a lull came over the long front, and Hitler and Halder began making plans for bringing up fresh troops and more tanks and guns to resume the offensive, at least on part of the front. Never again would they have the strength to attack all along the vast battle line. The bitter winter's toll and, above all, Zhukov's counteroffensive doomed that hope. But Hitler, we now know, had realized long before that his gamble of conquering Russia, not only in 6 months, but ever, had failed. In a diary entry of November 19, 1941, General Halder notes a long lecture of the Führer to several officers of the high command. Though his armies are only a few miles from Moscow and still driving hard to capture it, Hitler has abandoned hopes of striking Russia down this year and has already turned his thoughts to next year. Halder jotted down the leader's ideas. Goals for next year. First of all, the Caucasus. Objective? Russia's southern borders. Time, March to April. In the north, after the close of this year's campaign, Vologda or Gorky, but only at the end of May. Vologda, 300 miles northeast of Moscow, controlled the railway to Archangel. Gorky is 300 miles due east of the capital. Further goals for next year must remain open. They will depend on the capacity of our railroads. The question of later building an east wall also remains open. No east wall would be necessary if the Soviet Union were to be destroyed. Halder seems to have mulled over that as he listened to the Supreme Commander go on. On the whole, he concluded, one gets the impression that Hitler recognizes now that neither side can destroy the other, and that this will lead to peace negotiations. This must have been a rude awakening for the Nazi conqueror who 6 weeks before in Berlin had made a broadcast declaring, without any reservation, that Russia had been struck down and would never rise again. His plans had been wrecked, his hopes doomed. They were further dashed a fortnight later on December 6th when his troops began to be beaten back from the suburbs of Moscow. The next day, Sunday, December 7th, 1941, an event occurred on the other side of the round earth that transformed the European war, which he had so lightly provoked, into a world war, which, though he could not know it, would seal his fate and that of the Third Reich. Japanese bombers attacked Pearl Harbor. The next day, Hitler's movements and whereabouts are noted in his daily calendar book, which is among the captured documents, Hitler hurried back by train to Berlin from his headquarters at Wulfschanze. He had made a solemn secret promise to Japan, and the time had come to keep it or break it. Chapter 25. The Turn of the United States. Adolf Hitler's reckless promise to Japan had been made during a series of talks in Berlin with Yosuke Matsuoka, the pro-Axis Japanese foreign minister, in the spring of 1941, just before the German attack on Russia. The captured German minutes of the meetings enable us to trace the development of another one of Hitler's monumental miscalculations. They and other Nazi documents of the period show the Führer too ignorant, Göring too arrogant, and Ribbentrop too stupid to comprehend the potential military strength of the United States, a blunder which had been made in Germany during the First World War by Wilhelm II, Hindenburg, and Ludendorff. There was a basic contradiction from the beginning in Hitler's policy toward America. Though he had only contempt for her military prowess, he endeavored during the first 2 years of the conflict to keep her out of the war. This, as we have seen, was the main task of the German embassy in Washington, which went to great lengths, including the bribing of congressmen, attempting to subsidize writers and aiding the America First Committee, to support the American isolationists and thus help to keep America from joining Germany's enemies in the war. That the United States, as long as it was led by President Roosevelt, stood in the way of Hitler's grandiose plans for world conquest and the dividing up of the planet among the tripartite powers, the Nazi dictator fully understood, as his various private utterances make clear. The American Republic, he saw, would have to be dealt with eventually, and, as he said, severely, but one nation at a time. That had been the secret of his successful strategy thus far. The turn of America would come, but only after Great Britain and the Soviet Union had been struck down. Then, with the aid of Japan and Italy, he would deal with the upstart Americans, who, isolated and alone, would easily succumb to the power of the victorious Axis. Japan was the key to Hitler's efforts to keep America out of the war until Germany was ready to take her on. Japan, as Ribbentrop pointed out to Mussolini on March 11, 1940, possessed the counterweight to the United States, which would prevent the Americans from trying to intervene in Europe against Germany as they had in the First War. In their wartime dealings with the Japanese, Hitler and Ribbentrop at first stressed the importance of not provoking the United States to abandon her neutrality.